From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar.
And this week, we speak with Eric Dreitzer, political commentator and host of the website StopImperialism.org.
Eric, welcome back.
Don, thank you, my friend.
So, big deal, Brexit and the SCO and all the things that are going on. It's the whole planet is in I don't know what, it's in transition for sure.
Yeah, I suppose so. It's interesting because, you know, so much of the headlines have been dominated by the Brexit issue, I think quite rightly. Obviously, it's a very significant and momentous change, momentous happening in Europe. But I think it really kind of, in terms of the timing, it really overshadowed this Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit, which was happening in Tashkent in Central Asia, in Uzbekistan. And this is, I think, quite significant because really what you're seeing, and I suppose it's the theme of our conversation here today, is this sort of diverging paths that we see on the from the West and the East, where in the West we see an economic and political union now at risk, potentially beginning a slow unraveling process. Well, actually, maybe it's not even going to be that slow. Right. Potentially beginning an unraveling process, a dissolution, if you will, even if it's sort of a de facto one. At the very same time, we see a unification process or a cooperation process really beginning not just to emerge, but really beginning to take a more full expression right. in the East under the auspices of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
And the Eurasian Union, too.
Well, and the Eurasian Union is interesting, and maybe we should get to that in a little bit later because I have some questions about that too, but and how that relates to this issue. But broadly speaking, we had a monumental transformation take place with the SCO this year, specifically the first time that it has expanded to bring in new full members, not observer members, not, you know, participants or informal, you know, participants or whatever. But full members, India and Pakistan. And I think that that is a very significant development. And if you see it against the backdrop of what's happened in Europe and the sort of the dynamics of the geopolitics and the economics between East and West, I think this is potentially one of the most important issues that we have really anywhere in the world right now.
Yeah, you know, the unraveling that's going on in the West isn't just at the EU level, although that could end up being quite substantial and perhaps quite rapid. This is an aside. I'll mention that I was chatting with a Syriza MEP the other day and was about essentially a suggestion I made to him, which was might be a good time right now with what's happening across from Ireland on down to Greece for a Sexit, for the, you know, South countries to exit, or at least just to announce that they're discussing it and see what kind of renegotiated deal you can get, or just leave as a bloc.
Well, you know, I guess there's two questions there. On the one hand, if you're using it as sort of a cudgel in negotiations, that I can understand. On the other hand, the actual scenario of a whole, I guess, regional block of countries exiting out of the European Union, particularly a grouping of countries who are, objectively speaking, the weakest economic links in the European Union. I don't know logistically how that would work. You know, I mean, I remember Yanis Varoufakis at one point talking about the logistics of a Grexit and saying, you know, it's not exactly an easy thing to do when you don't have any mechanism to print your own currency, to make your own currency. Right. Your own currency. There are logistical concerns there. So I don't know, and I honestly don't know to what extent European, you know, elites in, you know, behind the in the driver's seat of the European Union, how seriously would they take a threat like a South exit out of the European Union, or would they call their bluff?
Yeah, who knows? And of course, yeah, you've got the issue with the currency and all of that. Then the unraveling also may be going even deeper. Even here in the West, they've noticed that Scotland and Northern Ireland voted to stay in, And this is, you know, in the context of the recent referendum that almost passed for secession by Scotland, and now many are anticipating, in fact, I think they've called for a new referendum on that point in Scotland, and they're anticipating that there may be enough to swing the vote.
Well, Nicola Sturgeon just said in her right. speech, which I recommend people listen to because I thought it was a pretty powerful speech and quite good. I mean, she said it very clearly, and I totally agree with her, that the conditions under which they voted to remain with the United Kingdom, the conditions under which they held that referendum have substantially and critically changed. Namely, they are now being dragged out of the European Union against their will, essentially, right. by the British specifically, and that because of that, when they voted in their referendum in 2014, it was essentially a referendum to stay in the European Union under the auspices of the United Kingdom. Right. Well, if the UK is going to leave the European Union, why should Scotland be forced to stay in the Union with the British? Why can't they say, you know what, we're finally separating away from the British, so that we can return or stay with the European Union? I mean, it makes perfect sense. I don't know what the numbers were, but my understanding, based on the last numbers that I saw, was that, I mean, it wasn't even close in Scotland. I mean, they were overwhelmingly in favor of staying with the EU.
Yeah. And
remember also, Scotland has a very different view politically and, I guess, culturally and socially, a very different view of the immigration issue, a very different view of what they perceive to be the benefits of the European Union, of European Union policies. And because of the politics of Scotland, specifically the SNP, the Scottish National Party, and their sort of left progressive framework and embedded in the Scottish working class, they have a completely different politics vis-a-vis immigration, migration in the EU than does the working class, much of the working class in Britain.
Yeah. Well, and you have to consider Scotland was one of England's first colonies, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
And in terms of historic value, I mean, this is really, I mean, how long has Scotland been a part of the UK?
Ha, wow. Yeah, I'm not positive. Right, yeah. I mean, when was the Mel Gibson movie? You know? No, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of years. Mm. So, a long time. And, well, I don't know that there's that much love lost there.
So, meanwhile, in the East...
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Meanwhile, in the East, you have, while this whole Brexit thing is happening, you have the leaders of Russia and China and Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan meeting in Tashkent in Uzbekistan for the 15th annual SCO summit, where they officially welcome India and Pakistan in. And of course, they also have an eye towards the future growth of the SCO. So I guess we could take those as two separate issues. I think that there's a lot of significance that we really do need to attach to India and Pakistan joining as full members. This is, I think, very significant because it brings up the following question. Does this now make the Shanghai Cooperation Organization a platform for international conflict resolution? Is there a potential for the economic and political cooperation agreements that come out of the SCO to really provide a foundation or a framework for addressing some of these decades-old conflicts between Pakistan and India? I'm certainly not suggesting that them joining the SCO means that they'll settle the Kashmir issue, or they'll settle the nuclear weapons issue, or they'll settle the stoking of terrorism issue, or any of that necessarily, right. But it certainly does raise the likelihood that there could be some constructive dialogue and constructive development, particularly if it's under the auspices of mutually beneficial economic arrangements with either Russia or China, especially China.
Right.
So I think that is really, really important here because, look, I think you and I know, and I'm sure everybody listening, or most everybody listening, our number one most important overriding commitment is to peace. We want peace. We want peace in the U.S. We want peace in North America, throughout Latin America, but we want peace globally. And how do you ensure peace and avoid war, particularly nuclear war? You create situations where both sides benefit from peace, where it is the more attractive option. And I think that joining the SCO certainly raises the likelihood that those countries will see a positive future for themselves in a cooperation rather than in a conflict. And again, there's many outstanding issues. And I know that a couple of weeks ago on this program, we were talking about a few of those, in particular, the, competition between Pakistan's Gwadar port and the Chabahar port in Iran, which is backed by India, and the potential for China to be involved. All of these issues really come to the fore when they're meeting at the SCO level. And I think that is really where we can see the significance of the SCO, not just that they have an annual meeting, but that they set the framework, build the architecture for these mutually beneficial arrangements that might finally have some kind of a breakthrough in terms of peace.
And, you know, China has within that an awful lot of soft power that it can, wield. And its development or its economic relations model is considerably more favorable to that kind of an operation than the one that the EU and the U.S. have. It's not a colonial or an imperial relationship. It's not a parasitic relationship. Certainly everyone is in it to make money. Certainly, both the Chinese state corporations and private capital in China are as greedy to grow as anyone else. But they seem to have an both the fact that there is so much development to be done in the world and that they have the apparatus, the engine for doing exactly that, and that can be profitable, that they've found a way to make that profitable, means that it's possible for them to do exactly what you're suggesting.
Oh, I totally agree. But I do think that what you said is important and we should address it. China as colonial, imperial, and parasitic. This is a really critical question because I don't see it that way, certainly. And I think that a lot of people, including people who are not explicitly pro-China or anti-imperialist or whatever, a lot of people would say very clearly that, look, China offers development. China offers these win-win arrangements. Maybe some are more win than others, certainly. No question about that. But the question is China colonializing or imperializing and exploiting the region? I would say no, where there may be, deficiencies in some of their investments. They may have made mistakes and things haven't gone according to, maybe the best development path in certain places, particularly I think in some of China's earlier investments. I think they've gotten a lot better, a lot more sophisticated and a lot more forward thinking in terms of these arrangements. But the United States and its allies are certainly and unquestionably cultivating exactly that mentality in Asia, the notion that China is the bully on the block, that China wants to dominate, that China is, as you mentioned, not that you were advocating this, but the idea that China is parasitical, that is something the U.S. is cultivating. And that's, in my view, one of the main reasons why you see the United States moving to establish this major university in Vietnam to be headed by Bob Kerry, ironically enough, the Vietnam War criminal Bob Kerry.
Right.
And why is the U.S. doing that? Speaking of soft power, which you mentioned earlier, right. Why are they doing that? Well, part of it is to bring up a new generation of sophisticated, highly educated Vietnamese people to believe that the U.S. has the best of intentions and China has the worst of intentions. So even within a country like Vietnam, which is really kind of situated in this political, no man's land between China and the U.S., even there you see this attempt to cultivate the very notion of China as exploitative, as China as parasitical, China as an imperial power.
You know, you have this is a long game, no matter what anyone's intent is.
And, sure.
And I think that China recognizes that. And Looking at the long game, essentially the economic model that the U.S. and EU offer to the developing countries is your stuff is now ours. And the one that China offers is basically, well, we have to grow too. About half the world or better is underdeveloped. We need rich clients to buy our stuff. Let's make them rich.
Yeah, that's right. Look, there's a great example here that could be pointed to. It's something that I've written a lot about, many others as well. I'm certainly not, you know, saying I'm the only one. And that's China's investment in Africa. Okay, if you look at China's investment in Africa, there's two ways of looking at that. You have a whole school of thought on the left where they say China is no different than the U.S., is no different than the IMF and the World Bank. They come to exploit the raw materials. They don't leave the countries any better. There's no real long-term development, et cetera, et cetera.
And I mean, it's capitalist. They treat it like these are the laws of capitalism, as you know, enunciated by Karl Marx and Frederick Engels.
Well, yeah, and specifically that China is basically little more than a capitalist imperialist power, and there's no difference, right? That is an entire school of thought on the left, which I reject personally.
A kindergarten I would call it, but yeah, okay.
What's that?
A kindergarten of thought, I would call it, instead of a school.
Well, and I mean, there are plenty of people who are highly intelligent and highly respected on the left to make those arguments. I mean, Patrick Bond is one of the most well-known writers on the subject, and that's exactly what he advocates. He calls BRICS a sub-imperial construct, whether or not, you know, basically a junior partner in global imperialism. Now, I don't see it that way exactly. I think it's different. I think there are certainly significant points that he makes, and I would not reject everything he says, but the thesis that he brings forward, I think, is false. So that school of thought is certainly there. Now, the question is, how successfully can the United States inculcate and its allies inculcate that idea, that framework of analysis into these various places and using its soft power apparatus? And I think that that's one of the gains. But my point in bringing up Africa, though, if you look at the kind of investment that China is doing, you have this whole avalanche of propaganda about China and land grabbing all over Africa, land grabbing here and land grabbing there. Well, guess what? Researchers, the most eminent researchers in the field, you know, in the world, have come out, including Deborah Brautigam, who is well known now as probably the foremost expert on China in Africa, including her, you know, landmark book, The Dragon's Gift, which really kind of, I think, is the sort of the bar against which all other China-Africa scholarship is measured. Deborah Brautigam's new book seeks to debunk the myth that China is land-grabbing in Africa. And actually, they go through a lot of field studies and a lot of analysis that they do in key areas of the continent to show that, in fact, no, China is not land-grabbing the way that the Western media has portrayed it, that it is more a function of geopolitical necessity for the propagandists in the West than it is of the actual reality, that China's stakes in some of these areas where they've been working with these African governments are actually quite small, and that it's actually more private Chinese investment than it is state Chinese investment that is really doing a lot of the heavy lifting in Africa, but that the real land grabbing that's going on is being done by Saudis and you know, Emiratis and Qataris and people like that who are buying up vast swaths of land in Africa. My point in bringing all of this up is that there is a propaganda narrative about what China is doing in Africa, and then there's the reality, and they're not necessarily the same thing, and they don't even necessarily reflect each other. And I think similarly in Asia, we see a lot of propaganda about what China can and can't do, about China's motivations or what their ulterior motives may be. And at the end of the day, I think that a lot of that is really a function of U.S. political necessity rather than actual careful analysis.
Yeah, that's, you mean, in other words, for the rhetorical value.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is you have to present China as the rising imperial colonial power. It has to be seen, as you said, as parasitical. If you are able to successfully create that image of China, then you're able to push forward the U.S. Western agenda. Ultimately, that's really what this is about. And to bring it back to our the subject of our conversation, to me, that's one of the most significant aspects of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, that it's not just China, that you have all of the countries of the region, now including the other Asian giant, India, and the critical Chinese partner of Pakistan, into this broader community of nations in the East. To me, that disarms at least some of the arguments that the U.S. Propagandists make. Now, this is not to say that every Chinese investment in Asia or in Africa is successful. They're not. That's not how investment works. But on the whole, I think that if you were to look at the leaders of those countries and, to a large extent, the peoples of those countries, you would get a very different impression than the one you get from the Washington Post or the New York Times.
Yeah, well, you know, the proof is in the pudding, too. Again, with reference to the fact that it's a long game, you know, when people are sitting down at a conference table, let's say you have a meeting, we're going to build, you know, this leg of the Silk Road or whatever through Pakistan. And now we're looking at bids. Give me a project design. Give me, you know, the business layout. Who's going to make money doing what, et cetera, et cetera. In the United States, the relationship is essentially, again, that's ours. And China is like, okay, so let's figure out the most efficient way to do this and let's share the money.
Yeah, and exactly. And don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that everybody is in love with China. Everybody in the region is in love with China. They're not. I've talked to people who have spent many years living in Vietnam who say that, you know, regardless of the legacy of the U.S. Destruction of Vietnam, generally, particularly young people are far more pro-U.S. than they are pro-China. And there's a number of reasons why, that the more conservative factions see a future with China, but that for various reasons, including cultural ones, a lot of people look towards the U.S. And again, even people who are really politically savvy and politically aware see China as, let's say, using its muscle in the South China Sea for intimidation purposes. That's how they see it. And I think that a lot and that opinion is pretty widespread in places like Vietnam and Malaysia to an extent, and some of these other countries, maybe less so in Thailand, I think probably true. But regardless of that, that needs to be considered. It needs to be taken into account. At the same time, we should consider the fact that the U.S. is exploiting that that skepticism, is exploiting that sort of side-eyed view, you know, towards China's motives. And that really needs to be, I think, considered. And that's one of the important things that China has to be able to overcome. China brings a lot of investment, but China also brings a lot of baggage for some of these countries, particularly like Vietnam, which from time immemorial has had very, you know, strained relations with the power to the north.
And let's shift focus a little bit from Asia and you know the area surrounding it to Latin America. A number of important developments over the past week. You have the OAS attempt to invoke the charter to authorize intervention on the side of the right wing in the National Assembly because of Maduro refusing to allow a referendum on his remaining in office.
Which they are now allowing anyway, yeah. So, you know, whatever.
Yeah. And then you have what's happening in Argentina on the ground, and you have also what's been happening in Brazil on the ground, and the announcement of a ceasefire in Colombia.
A lot of developments, obviously. You know, I think that I'm trying to drag Asia along in this conversation, but it is important as sort of a segue into that to remember that a country like Venezuela and Argentina and Brazil, for that matter, were all seen as really integral to China's strategy in the Western Hemisphere. China was looking particularly at Venezuela as being a linchpin of Chinese, not just Chinese penetration of Latin America, but Chinese commercial commercial interests all throughout the Western Hemisphere being able to compete with, if not undermine, U.S. Economic hegemony in the West. And Venezuela figured centrally in that. I think a lot of people, I suppose there's debate about it, but a lot of people feel that that's been scaled back significantly. Some people have argued that that's been a failure, and the Chinese are really abandoning this sort of Venezuela as a central focus for them strategy. And I suppose it would make sense that because China's economy has slowed, because obviously Venezuela's economy is in a very severe crisis, and for a lot of other reasons. But ultimately, we should sort of keep in our minds that China does have a Latin America strategy, and broadly speaking, the SCO really has a Latin America strategy, including Russia, which has vocally voiced its support for some of the governments that have been under attack by the right wing in Latin America. So yes, I think it's quite significant. And then, of course, seen in the context of the ongoing development of the Chinese-funded, Chinese-backed canal in Nicaragua, which is really, sort of a game changer for China's economic penetration and also just for Chinese commercial shipping, right? I mean, if Chinese exports and Chinese goods are able to traverse through the Nicaragua Canal and bypass the U.S.-dominated Panama Canal, well, that significantly alters the, call it, the landscape of global trade, particularly with the most important manufacturing center in the world, China.
Right, and the cost structure, too.
Yeah, and again, I'm not suggesting that there aren't going to be problems associated with that. I have friends who have, worked with some of the groups, including indigenous groups in Nicaragua, who are not happy about this, including, the environmental concerns and all of that. I appreciate all of that and certainly understand it. However, ultimately, you have to understand that when a country that is really a poor country, a resource-poor country, and just an economically poor country, one that has been under the thumb of and domination of the United States for so long, for so many decades, including the vicious Contra War and God knows how many murdered by U.S.-backed death squads and so forth. If you consider all of that, one has to understand why a country like Nicaragua would look at China, and particularly such a massive investment like China's making in that canal, as a potential guarantor of some level of independence.
Yep.
How could the Chinese allow the U.S. to once again come to dominate Nicaragua entirely if China has tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars riding on access to that canal? Of course. I mean, it only makes sense. It's interests.
Do you think there'll be a canal zone set up?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, well, I don't know that the Chinese, speak softly and carry a big stick quite in the same way that the U.S. of, Teddy Roosevelt's time did. However, I will say that I suppose one could argue that the Chinese speak softly and leave the stick at home, but can get it if they need it.
The also, we need to look at this in the context of the BRICS, with Brazil, of course, being the B in BRICS, and the aspirations for a rising multipolar world that represented or still represents.
Yeah, I mean, I've written about it and talked about it a lot, BRICS as, really targeted by the West. Now, again, I want to clarify, because you wouldn't believe how much negative response I get on this issue. Just to clarify, I have never suggested and would never suggest that BRICS represents an alternative to global capitalism. It does not. It is part of global capitalism. But it is also an independent grouping, one that is able to provide some modicum of an alternative to the neoliberal finance capital system dominated by the West. I personally think that is very important. When countries in the global South especially have a second option, rather than just, either don't develop or submit to the will of the IMF and the World Bank, when they have the option of something like, you know, BRICS Development Bank or the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and things like that. I think that that is obviously it's beneficial to these countries. Certainly, we know that it is not some, you know, socialist grouping. It's not a, you know, an anti-capitalist utopian framework or anything like that. But it certainly is an alternative. And I personally think that that is important as we move into a period of global economic crisis, which I think is inevitable. And, you know, many others, including Michael Hudson and, you know, Jack Rasmus and many others have said precisely that point, that the global capitalist system is on the verge of a major crisis, if not a breakdown. In that scenario, I think having something like BRICS, which may or may not be a lasting grouping, but I think it's quite important. And obviously, look, the West thinks so too. If they didn't, they wouldn't be working so hard to undermine it.
Yeah, and its individual members.
Yeah, exactly. Look at Brazil. Look at South Africa. Look at the way that the U.S. has focused its attention on doing everything it can to undermine Russia. This is not to say that Russia's all, you know, perfect on every count and doesn't make mistakes or that we have to agree with everything Russia does. It simply points out the objective reality. Countries like Brazil and Russia and China and South Africa, they're in the crosshairs. There's really no denying it at this point.
And, you know, this past week, Ashton Carter got up and laid out the five big threats to the U.S. That they consider from a military perspective. And the list was Russia, China, I don't remember if Iran, North Korea, and ISIS in that order. And Andy said, when he said ISIS wherever it is in the world. And he said, we can't choose among them which to do. We have to do them all.
Yes, exactly right. I mean, talk about imperialist, warmongering. I mean, my God, I think that that is, I think that's right. I think that that, look, he said it plainly. He's not wrong. That is how the U.S. establishment sees it. That is how the outlook is from Washington, namely that all of those things need to happen simultaneously. And I think, again, if you look at it just objectively, the U.S. sees these countries coming together in a more formalized manner as deeply threatening to what you talked about earlier, its global hegemony or the unipolarity of U.S. power. And if we are moving in the direction of a more multipolar global economic and political order, well, that carries with it certain ramifications, and obviously I don't need to spell out all of the what all of those mean, but I do think that it's important to see how the West and the US and its allies are pushing back, and even within BRICS. I mean, we've talked at length about it on this show in the last few months. You know, a country like India, right? India is moving into the SCO, into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It's moving closer to China and to Russia and to all of these countries, and at the very same moment, it's signing military deals with the United States. Right. It's actually moving closer to the U.S. militarily. What does that mean? Well, from India's perspective, they're trying to guarantee their own power in South Asia against what they perceive to be a still remaining rival, namely China. China and India have these ongoing conflicts, including that border dispute, including a lot of longstanding mutual distrust that goes back to the days of the Sino-Soviet split and, you know, India's close association with the Soviet Union and all of that stuff. So, I mean, these things run really, really deep. So the question is, to return back to the beginning of our conversation, the question really is, does the Shanghai Cooperation Organization represent a potential conflict resolution platform? Is this a way that India and China, or India and Pakistan, or even China and Russia, for that matter, really do sit, not just sit down at the table together, but form lasting partnerships that are not just marriages of convenience, but they're legitimate alliances? We saw Chinese troops marching in Red Square a year and a half ago, or a year ago, at the 70th anniversary of of Victory Day in Moscow. We saw similarly Russian troops in Beijing. We've seen this happen, and these things are symbolic, but they have a certain political resonance, in my view, and increasingly we're seeing that happening. So the question is, what happens next for the SCO? They bring in India. They bring in Pakistan. Iran has been turned down, at least as of now. Based on my understanding, Iran was looking to be the next participant to have accession to the SCO, and it doesn't necessarily look like that's happening, at least not in 2017, okay? So what does that mean? Well, I don't know. Maybe it means that Iran simply just has to come back in a different way and apply for 2018. Maybe it means that Iran is not going to be a member of the SCO. I think that would be a tremendous mistake on the part of the members of the SCO, because they would be essentially forcing Iran to look west for its investment, for the capital investment that it really desperately needs. And it would almost be a means of driving the Iranians into the arms of European corporations rather than into the arms of Chinese and Russian corporations. So I think that's something definitely to watch. And then another critical aspect of all of this, and it's almost never discussed, and I really don't know why, but that's Afghanistan. I mean, a post-occupation Afghanistan is literally and figuratively central to all of these projects that the Chinese are pursuing, that the Russians are pursuing, and the Indians, for that matter. They have significant investments in Afghanistan, particularly in raw material extraction. India is looking at Iran as the focal point of its strategy to get those raw materials out of Afghanistan using the port at Chabahar. So what I'm getting at, and I know I'm sort of reeling off, you know, a lot of things here, but the point is all of these things are interrelated. That's why this is so interesting to watch. That's why when you see Brexit completely overshadowing the SCO meeting, I have to pause and say, wait a second, it's an open question which of these is even more important.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't even know it's an open question. Well, I mean, again, yeah, right. What you're looking at are two almost antithetical conditions. One is one of dissolution and the other is one of consolidation.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm not, you know, a doomsday prognosticator for the EU. I don't see the EU coming apart at the seams, you know, overnight, the way that some people have said. I think the EU is actually stronger than a lot of people want to give it credit for. I think that there's definitely going to be a bit of a backlash against this sort of far right campaigning against the EU, which much of it, not all of it, but much of it being predicated on xenophobia, anti-immigration, anti-refugee kind of hysteria. And again, I think that we should be cautious to, you know, predict the collapse of the European Union, given that it is so critical to the Western system, the Western global system. I mean, sure, they have invested decades into the European project. They're not going to let it unravel because some leftists and a bunch of right-wing elements in Britain are, you know, not in favor of it. They're not going to let it unravel just because of a couple of pesky little countries like Greece or, you know, other countries in the South or what have you. So we, as always, need to be looking for the inevitable pushback. Where's that pushback going to come? And how do we need to read the political landscape in Europe? Look, I don't think it's a good strategy, especially for people on the left, to ignore the resurgence and ascendancy of far right elements all over Europe, including in Britain. I mean, we saw a Brexit movement that was championed by certain elements of the left, to be sure, including my friend George Galloway, who I love and respect and have for so long. It was so important to my own political development, including the Communist Party of Great Britain, including a number of other elements. John Pilger and many others have written, you know, from the left perspective on why Brexit is a good thing. And I appreciate all of that. But we should also have our eyes open to the fact that it was the far right that really spearheaded this movement and has for years. Nigel Farage and the UK Independence Party, Boris Johnson, the far right wing of the Tory Conservative Party, the BNP, the British Nationalist Party, which is basically a more or less a neo-Nazi organization, along with the EDL, the English Defense League. I mean, these are fascist elements who really take this Brexit issue as a huge victory that emboldens them. And I don't think we should have our eyes closed to that fact, just as we shouldn't have our eyes closed to what Trump means for the United States. Not Trump himself, but the movement that has congealed around him, I think is something very important to watch, and it shouldn't be underestimated. And the reason I say that is if you look across the board, I was thinking just the other day, Don, I wanted to put this together in like some kind of a line graph or something, but you take parties like the UK Independence Party, the PVV, the Nationalist Party in the Netherlands, led by Geert Wilders. You look at the National Front, led by Marine Le Pen. Right. You look at Jobbik in Hungary, Golden Dawn in Greece, Liga Nord in Italy. All of these parties, whether from the far-right nationalist to the real fascist Nazi parties of the extreme right of the political spectrum, they're all in the ascendancy. You're looking at far-right movements in every one of these countries and others. Sweden Democrats is another example. You're looking at all of these far-right parties growing, not shrinking, growing in power. If you put that against the backdrop of a global economic crisis, against the backdrop of a dissolving European Union, what do you think that's a recipe for?
Yeah, well, then you have to ask yourself, how did you get here? And one of the reasons is that the left is not stepped up to own some of these things.
Exactly.
Because there are reasons for the left, as, for example, the British Communist Party lays out, the reasons for the left to have wanted a Brexit. There are reasons even for those who were thinking in geopolitical strategic terms to see, you know, they impute this to Putin, of course, but, you know, it is a blow for multipolarity to see if the EU ideally became independent, but if not that, then its power as an appendage of the U.S. Power being projected at Russia, China, etc., it would be impaired. But if you look at the class basis of it, really, moving forward, you end up with this odd coalition of, or in any event, coincidence of the left or some on the left and these far right forces. Once you've achieved the unity demand, like Brexit, now you sit down and you talk about, okay, now what do we do that we're here? And selling the idea of prioritizing immigration over the idea of developing jobs is going to be a hard sell to the working class. And if the left knows what they're doing, they'll be organizing around exactly those things, because the issues themselves, the idea of immigration and all of that as a threat is a diversion from dealing with the class-based issues. That's what the right wing always does. And when it comes time to sit down at the table and say this is going to be policy, that's where the left has to provide some very serious leadership.
I agree. And where is that leadership? I don't see it anywhere. I see no left leadership of that kind. Yeah, we could talk about it all we want. I totally agree. That's exactly the vacuum that the left is supposed to fill. But where is it?
Yeah.
There is no organized left. You know who's organized? It's the far right.
That's right.
They're organized, as is so often the case.
Well, that's my point. My point is that's the work that has to be done.
Right. No, I understand that. But when we're talking about the implications of what just happened, we look at it given the current conditions. And given the current conditions under which all of this is taking place, it is the far right that benefits here. It is the far right that really emerges the true victory, you know, victorious element in all of this. Certainly, if we now see an internecine conflict within formerly the Brexit camp between the left and the right, that's great. But do you have faith that the left, particularly obviously the left that was in favor of Brexit, are able to really challenge in a fundamental way? I don't mean mount some protests. Obviously, they can do that. I mean challenge for political power in a real and fundamental way.
Not without organizing it. That is the task ahead. You do the analysis, and the purpose of doing the analysis is to see what is to be done, essentially. And that precisely is what is to be done.
I understand that. I agree with that. What I'm saying, though, is that when we're doing the analysis, we have to look at what is the immediate, medium-term, and long-term impact of this. And yep, I see it as mixed. Yeah. I don't see it in the way that, you know, the great John Pilger sees it exactly. You know, I respect him tremendously, and I appreciate everything he's saying. I understand all of the arguments, but I don't see it as a great, you know, triumph and victory for raw democracy or whatever. I see it as a much more mixed bag. And I think that we need to really carefully examine the implications of all of this, because, look, is it a better Europe if you had an EU that dissolves, these countries return to their, you know, more or less a sort of national sovereignty, each one individually, and you see all of those elements that I named rising into power? That's a very real possibility. In fact, given current trends, that might be the most likely outcome of a dissolution of the European Union. If you were to see something like that against the backdrop of all these things happening globally, that's a very, very, very dangerous cocktail in Europe. Now, obviously, there are countries and interests that stand to benefit from that. But in my view, it's not the working class. It's certainly not the working class, despite all of the promises and protestations to the contrary. A lot of working class people in Britain voted to exit the European Union. Some for very awful racist and xenophobic reasons. Many for very good economic reasons. Just as there are many people in the U.S. who are pissed off and are supporting Trump for very good economic reasons, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily, that should be supported, for one, or that we should be blind to what is driving a lot of this. And look, I don't think we should underplay, and I know that I'm not the first person to say this, but I don't think we should downplay the parallel between what we're seeing in the U.S. around Trump and what we're seeing in Europe, in particular around Brexit. I think that there are some very real similarities, and obviously part of it is a reaction against these decades of neoliberal catastrophe that the working class has been dealing with. But against that, we also see the sort of the bubbling up of the kind of racism and ethnocentric, values that has been embedded in the white working class from time immemorial. And I think that these are questions we shouldn't shy away from.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, it's not just this phenomenon being expressed behind Trump. This is the same thing that was expressed behind Sanders. And
oh, yeah, exactly.
To be critical of that and of the response from Sanders and from the establishment, in apparent opposition. You have a division of the working class behind Sanders and Trump, mainly, of an insurgent political movement in any event, or a pair of insurgent political movements that are based in the working class, that resound from working class issues. Division is over issues of race and immigration, which is particularly bedeviling through the history of the working class in the United States. And failures on both sides. On the one hand, those behind Trump, their failure to criticize on those issues. And on the other hand, the failure to criticize Sanders on those issues internationally. You know, you can't be a democratic socialist imperialist. And Sanders has not really expressed, even as much as Trump has, an antipathy towards the current imperial policy, not towards imperial policy, but towards the current imperial policy. And that's a failing of, it may not be, who knows what Sanders' intent is, but certainly in terms of providing leadership for the anti-racist working class that's mobilized, it's a failure of leadership. And you see the voters, those behind Sanders and Trump, those behind Sanders getting divided up behind voting for Hillary Clinton, neoliberal imperialism, or Donald Trump, whatever the hell that is, or voting for third party candidates and looking outside the political system, which may happen. Certainly, the libertarians are being massaged. They're getting an awful lot of media coverage, and even now,
yeah, isn't that convenient?
Yeah, well, of course. And but you had the effect of that driving Jill Stein up. Also, she's at 7% in some poll last week or something, which is maybe 7-8 times more than the Greens have ever polled at. And she was even on the crawl on CNN Friday for like three blurbs. You know, when you see all of that happening, I mean, you have, again, like you said, in Europe, the same phenomena being replicated. You know, the task seems to be, for example, if there's going to be a Grexit, it has to be provided by Syriza or some other left construct and not allow Golden Dawn to capture that, because that is something that has the attention of the working class in Greece.
But they have. That's exactly the point. And
yeah,
I agree with everything you're saying. Yes, exactly. I agree. And Golden Dawn is a great example of that. Golden Dawn was one of the first parties, one of the first entities in all of Europe to congratulate the British on the Brexit, right?
Of course, yep.
They have seized the political space, the anti-EU political space. And that's part of the reason why there are many people, regular people in the working class, who are gravitating towards things like Golden Dawn and parties that are similar to it. And remember, I mean, Golden Dawn, even down to their iconography, is a fascist party. I mean, this is a fascist party. There's no denying that they are Nazis, right? And this is a very dangerous moment, because if you look at you and I don't 100% agree about Syriza. I think I'm a bit harder on Syriza than you are. But regardless of that, whether you think Syriza has, you know, held their ground or failed or, you know, capitulated or whatever, ultimately, Syriza represents a pro-EU position. They have not really taken an anti-EU position from the left. There really is an anti-EU position on the left in Greece, represented by the KKUE, the Greek Communist Party, but they're still polling at very low numbers. And while they can turn out trade unionists into the streets, they're not winning elections anytime soon. Golden Dawn, on the other hand, is now the third largest party in Greece. Right. They have a significant amount of influence, and they have international standing with a lot of the Euroskeptics of the far right. This is an important point to make, that in this political climate, given the sort of mostly ineffectual, if not utterly feckless, political posturing from most parties of the left in Europe, they have thrown the door wide open to a very, very ugly specter of fascism on the European continent. And I think it's a huge mistake for the left to underestimate the significance of that. Unfortunately, and I know, you know, I don't want to, like, you know, the sky is falling, everyone is Hitler, everyone's a fascist. I'm not suggesting that. What I'm saying, though, is that history shows the danger of underestimating the threat of fascists in Europe, and particularly underestimating the threat when the left has failed. The left failed in the late 1920s and early 1930s, and it led to disaster.
Well, and you might remember that one part of the failure of the left in 1932 was to back von Hindenburg, which is what many on the left are advocating.
Exactly.
You know, they're holding out Clinton as von Hindenburg without remembering or reminding people that von Hindenburg made Hitler chancellor and then signed the basic law that handed over the state to the Nazi Party.
That's exactly right. 100% right. I totally agree. That's exactly the kind of blundering that the left has done, and I think is continuing to do in a lot of ways. Now, I'm not suggesting that, you know, somebody like a Jeremy Corbyn or whatever might not be able to do something totally unexpected. But given what we know and given what we've seen, and I heard he sacked Hillary Benn, which is a good thing. I mean, that's good. Maybe he's growing a pair, maybe a slightly larger pair or whatever. You know, but ultimately, I don't have a ton of faith in Labour and the left in general in Britain to really be able to capitalize on this, given the way that the right is going to capitalize on it. Now, if you took a more internationalist perspective here, forget the European Union. This is a neoliberal imperialist's wet dream. We all know this. It's right. Neoliberalism to the nth degree. It is a political construct of finance capital. It is a wholly owned subsidiary of the City of London and Wall Street and the banks in Frankfurt. We know all of that. There's no denying that. There's never going to be a pro-EU argument from me. I'm very much against it for all of those reasons and more. But all of that being said, I don't think we should be blind to the political reality of the forces that are emerging in Europe. It's very, very scary what's happening. I wrote in January of 2014, before the coup that removed that toppled the Yanukovych government in Ukraine, I wrote an article called "Ukraine and the Rebirth of Fascism in Europe." Okay, and Ukraine was an opening salvo in some ways of what we've seen over the last couple of years. All of these parties are growing. That is an objective fact. And they're growing significantly. And they're growing in very important sectors of their populations, including among the working class. How does the left respond? From my perspective, from what I've seen, they haven't responded.
On that note, thank you very much, Eric. Pleasure as always.
Thanks, Don.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host. And look forward to seeing you again next week.